Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 25th episode of Robots, where we'll be speaking about swarms of small robots for research and real-world applications. Our first guest, Nicholas Carell, is a researcher at MIT in the US. He'll be presenting his past research on swarms of minuscule robots to inspect reactor turbines and his latest research on cooperating networks.
Our second guest, Rodrigue Gross, will be speaking about his slightly larger swarming robots, or swarm bots, which have been used in the past years to investigate cooperation and decentralized control for tasks such as search and rescue or cooperative exploration. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Germany's automation technology giant Festo has built a group of robot penguins. The robots try to replicate the body shape and fin movements of one of nature's most efficient swimmers and can autonomously navigate using 3D sonar. Like previous bio-inspired projects such as robotic manta rays and robotic jellyfish, the robots serve as both a model and testbed for new bio-inspired technologies. Festool's goal is to use bio-inspiration to develop innovative solutions to automation tasks. One such innovation, a tripod gripper, far transcending operating range of conventional grippers, was demonstrated along with the robot penguins. In what is beginning to look like a trend, more robot actors take to the stage. The Swiss Barnaby Theatre follows in the footsteps of Japan's first robot-human theatre production, a performance of The Phantom of the Opera in Taiwan last year. The play revolves around a lonely man living in isolation with his three robots. The autonomous acting robots were developed by Swiss service robotics specialist Bluebotics. Staying in Switzerland, Frederick Kaplan from the EPFL and designer Martino Disposito have launched an interactive disc jockey robot. The QB1 interacts with people through gestures. It uses infrared lights and a camera to detect body movement and performs face recognition through 3D modeling. In return, the robot's screen moves to look toward you, displaying a shadow of your movements and an intuitive interface. The first version uses 5 different strategies to predict what music you want to listen to at the moment, intelligently building an increasingly complex model of your preferences. For more information on Festo's bio-inspired projects, autonomously acting robots, and the interactive disc jockey robot, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Nicholas Carell is a postdoc at the Distributed Robotics Lab at MIT, where he's been trying all sorts of distributed systems, from actual cows in a herd to ad hoc wireless communication networks and distributed robotic gardens. However, in this interview, we'll be mainly concentrating on some of the previous research he did during his PhD here at the EPFL on sugar cube-sized robots which can be used to inspect the compressor section of a turbine engine. He'll be telling us about why a collective system is interesting for such tasks and what are the trade-offs between having robots which plan or walk around randomly and cooperate to different degrees.
Hi, Nicholas. We're now in the CSAIL laboratory where you work with Daniela Roos on distributed robotics.
Hi, Sabina.
During your PhD, you investigated collaborative coverage with a self-organized swarm of tiny robots. What was the goal of your project?
The goal of my PhD thesis was to explore different coordination mechanisms and study resource trade-offs in the robotic system.
And what was the envisioned application?
So what we've been doing is we worked on distributed coverage, which I consider is a canonical problem in robotics. And the application was very far-fetched to have the swarm of robots inspect a jet turbine.
What does a jet turbine look like? What kind of robots do you need to investigate that?
So the jet turbine was a very motivating case study because you actually need very, very small robots in order to get into that. And so this also motivated us to study what can you achieve with which kind of robot? What kind of sensors do you need in order to improve your performance? And so we explored this by experimenting with different coordination schemes and also with different sensors, so localization, different ways of communicating among the robots.
And what type of robots were used?
So we've been using the ALICE platform developed at EPFL by Jill Caprari. It's a kind of sugar cube robot, less than a cubic inch. It's 2x2 centimeters footprint. And it has four infrared sensors, which can be used for exchanging nibbles at very low bandwidth and detecting other robots in a range of 3 centimeters. The robot itself has very little RAM and very little computational power. So we added a communication module for Zigbee communication and a camera for 30 by 30 pixel color images and localizing the robot in the environment.
In this investigation task, what did the robots have to do? They had to cover the area, right?
That's true. So we abstracted the turbine by a set of blades, and the point was that the robots had to circumnavigate each of these blades, and this makes it kind of a task allocation problem where you have every blade being one task and the robots trying to organize themselves to finish or complete all tasks in the shortest possible time.
Why did you go towards having many robots instead of having one single robot?
So using many robots has many advantages, especially when the environment is so small or has so many constraints that a single robot would be of too limited capabilities. So in the jet turbine example, the turbine is just so huge in comparison to the size of a robot you would be able to get in there that it would take for ages until the task would have been completed. So there, a lot of robots will help you to get it done much faster.
You've been looking at 4 different ways to make these tiny robots collaborate. You've been looking at a reactive mechanism, deliberative, coordinated, and non-coordinated. Can you maybe explain these 4 extremes?
Right. In a reactive approach, robots don't plan, but actually just act based on their current state and the current sensor input. This is contrary to a deliberative approach where robots really plan and use all the history or even other information to make their decisions. With this information of other robots, we come to the coordination aspect. So the highest degree of coordination is definitely when you not only exchange information, but you also agree upon who's doing what. On the other extreme, you are not coordinated at all. And this is when you just basically are acting on your own. This can be both in a reactive control scheme, where you just walk essentially randomly. It can also be that you have a very, very sophisticated planner, but you just don't care what the other robots do. So that would be the highest form of deliberation, but the lowest form of coordination.
Within your turbine scenario, can you give us some insight on how the robots would act within these 4 categories?
So in the reactive, non-coordinated approach, the robots would actually roam through the turbine like grains of sand. So they move essentially randomly. They don't memorize where they have been, and the model for this would be essentially taking marbles out of a sack and putting them back and then counting the time until you have them all collected. The other extreme would be the deliberative coordinated approach, where the robots would know the turbine environment from the beginning on and then would collaboratively come to a plan that would send each robot to a subset of the blades. In my experiments, I had a section of the turbine that I modeled on a table, and I used the turbine blades as tasks which have to be inspected by each robot. And so what happens in the reactive algorithm, the robots would essentially randomly walk between these blades, and as soon as they run into one, they would attach to it and circumnavigate it for a given time and then leave it. This is what I considered as an inspection. In the deliberative approach, the robots would move in a coordinated fashion from blade to blade, and there I had a series of pre-programmed reactive algorithms or mechanisms for having the robot move around the blade. So there was a round tip and a sharp tip, and the robots could detect this sharp tip using their onboard sensors, and this was essentially how they could navigate on the blade. So in order to go from one blade to the other, it was usually a combination of detecting this sharp tip, moving in a pre-programmed fashion, and then doing a turn and moving to the next blade.
So if you had to compare these two approaches, what would be your conclusion?
So the conclusion was that whenever you plan more, you actually improve your metric. Because what actually happens in the previous example, robots actually do fail. And so what we needed to do is to continuously replan their trajectories in order to become optimal. However, if you want to do this approach where everything is known beforehand and you plan optimally, you need quite a lot of resources. So the conclusion here is that you actually have to investigate what kind of resources will be available and then exploit these resources as good as possible. So the conclusion is actually that there's no better or worse here. Of course, the performance is better the more you plan. However, you need quite some resources for doing that. In our case, we needed this camera that enabled us to localize in the environment, and we needed the radio to exchange this information. And also, we needed some processing in order to calculate the optimal solution. None of these might be actually feasible in a real setup. So, especially in the turbine environment, communication might be quite difficult due to the shielded structure of the turbine. And you might be able to exchange information before you go in, but as soon as you're inside, you're probably on your own. And so you have this continuum in the performance and this continuum in the resource constraints. And one contribution here of my thesis was to come up with appropriate models for all of these scenarios, and which allow you to study what would happen if your sensor would fail with a certain probability, and what would happen if you would have this additional information.
When you said the robots could collaborate, what information could they exchange, and how did they decide basically on who would do what?
So the information that the robots exchanged was basically the location of blades they have inspected, as well as blades that still need to be inspected. Based on that information, they could decide who does what by using a deterministic planning algorithm. And you could decide on who is doing what by acknowledging the information. What we did, however, was to use a deterministic algorithm that did the task allocation. And so every robot could decide by itself what he will gonna do and what all the other robots are gonna do in order to avoid this or prevent the robots from doing the same blade twice.
Did you see situations where the reactive non-collaborative scenario actually works better than a system which is planned?
Yes, actually the thing was, in order to navigate according to your plan, you have to be very careful and you have to move very slowly. The robot has to take a lot of sensor measurements, and this might take a lot of time. While if you do something reactively, you can just run through the turbine as fast as possible. And it turned out that in our particular implementation, a random walking robot or reactive controlled robot could do 4 blades in the time that a deliberatively planning robot could do 1. And so at that point, it is essentially like taking 4 balls out of a ballot randomly, and you eventually will complete all of the ballots us to take them out systematically, but in a much longer time. So what we think is that if you have a lot of blades, the reactive approach will suffer because it will take very long time for the robots to find the last one, while the deliberative algorithm probably scales better to that scenario.
So I guess it really depends on your application. If you have an application where it's not important to be perfect, then you would maybe go for a reactive approach. And it depends on the size as well.
Yes, it depends on the size and it depends on the application. However, what I discovered doing that work was that it makes a lot of sense to start thinking about the most simplest approach that you can do and then see what you would need in order to move on and to improve your performance. If you follow this scheme, then you are very likely that if your sensors or planning algorithms fail, you have a very robust baseline solution that the robots will fall back to. And this is also what I try to do in my current research, to again start from the simplest possible algorithm and then move up incrementally and try to maintain the robustness and provable properties of the baseline solution.
From the tiny sugar cube robots, you've gone on to working with bigger robots, the iCreate ones. Can you maybe present your new work to us?
Currently, I also work on a coverage case study, and it's about putting wireless access points, so routers that we all have at home, on a very simple robotic platform and have the robots deploy these routers such that the area which has internet access is maximized. I choose the iRobot Create platform because it is quite a handy one, which has very limited capabilities. Again, it has a bumper sensor and differential wheel drive. So here the idea would be to have a platform that can be easily miniaturized and is potentially cheap to acquire.
Many researchers are trying to make mesh networks. What is different when the nodes start to become mobile?
This is a very interesting question. And so there are quite some few mesh networking approaches. So there's the MIT RoofNet, which turned into a company, Meraki, which is in the Bay Area. There are quite some few free networks like RoofNet in Berlin and Robin in Italy. They all focus on static nodes, so apartments and apartment houses and complexes where you have these networks. It's not really clear to me what's going to happen if you move very fast, and I believe that these algorithms probably need modification if this happens. In my case, I will try to move very slowly in order to come close to the static environment, but I think on the long term we have to work more in this direction and actually study how the mobility will affect the ad hoc networking capabilities. So we also work on another project, or I'm collaborating on another project, where cars are equipped with wireless radios in the Boston area. And one of my collaborators, Jakob Eriksson, who works with Hari Balakrishnan, is able now to hook up to wireless networks just during a few hundreds of milliseconds exposure time. And I think this is very important to move towards this direction, to decrease the time network protocols actually need to acknowledge on a connection and so on. And I guess this will be very important for robotics, where you have very quickly changing topologies.
Where do you think we'll be seeing such mesh networks in the future?
I think this mesh networking is definitely a key technology in distributed robotics, because you will always need a robust backbone for communication, be it for first responders in a search and rescue scenario, where you might have Skype phones that you give to the rescue workers and they use that backbone created by the robots for communicating, be it for more sophisticated individual robots that use the communication backbone for navigation and communication and potentially sensing. Also, in for distributed sensing applications where currently people are using modes, but maybe do require more computation and more data rate or higher bandwidth between the nodes. I think wireless ad hoc networks, so 800 to 11B networks, are probably very important technology.
Let's speak a bit about the future now. What area of robotics do you think will have had the biggest impact on our lives in the future?
So, of course, I have to answer distributed robotics. However, I think it's actually an easy answer because I don't think there will be too many individual robots helping us at all. So even in factories, if you think about it, the robots are essentially distributed and the parts move from station to station. We will potentially have robotic cars which communicate with their neighbors. We might have robots at home that are relying on a huge array of sensors in our apartments, in our fridges, in our heating systems. And so I think studying these coordination schemes that drive these distributed systems is an extremely important research.
And what do you think will be the main challenges to solve?
I think the main challenges to solve right now in robotics is actually to create critical mass and create some platforms and infrastructure that allow people to move on. I think when I think on the IT revolution, it was the spreadsheet that enabled the mass market to, it was the killer application that enabled the computer to the masses. For robotics, to find this kind of spreadsheet application is probably much more difficult because you not only need to program a software application, but you need to build the whole system. You have to have the sensors, you have to have the tool chains, you have to have the microcontrollers. And so I think we need a lot more of applications and research in robotics in order to really make this leap to have the robotics becoming ubiquitous in our lives.
Thanks, Nicholas.
Thanks, Sabine.
Our second guest today, Rodrige Gross, is now a postdoc at the EPFL after receiving his PhD from the Free Brussels University for his work on self-assembling robots. He'll be telling us about his current work in collective robotics, including areas such as cooperation of robots, self-assembly, and division of labor.
Good afternoon, Roderick. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hi, Adam.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm currently a postdoc here at the EPFL in Switzerland, working under the supervision of Francesco Mondara in a project on self-assembling robots. And that's also what my PhD was about, which I carried out at the Université Libre de Bruxelles under the supervision of Professor Marco Dorigo.
Okay, tell us a little bit about your work and what self-assembly of robots is exactly. What does that mean?
Okay, so if you have multiple robots, one way of interacting with each other is that they physically connect one to the other and thereby form a larger connected entity. And then they can, for example, work in a group as such a larger connected entity. It's one way of cooperation.
And why would you want to work at a group? What advantage does that give? Can you give us an example, maybe?
Well, so in general, working in groups sometimes can help the robots to tackle problems that are too difficult that they could not achieve when working alone. For example, consider a mobile robot that drives on a terrain towards a certain location. And when, let's say, it encounters a large gap in the ground, and if the robot continues to go on, it will simply fall into this gap. However, if you have a group of robots and if they're connecting with each other, they would self-assemble, they would form a connected entity that is wide enough, large enough to bridge the gap, so and to achieve the task. So the idea is you have a robotic organism, you have a system that can form organisms of larger sizes and even also of larger strength than any, let's say, predefined robot, and which gives you more flexibility.
So I guess this is a little bit like those ant bridges where ants have to go from a leaf to another or something, and they create a bridge with a whole bunch of ants put together.
Exactly, yes. This is where our inspiration comes from. So the inspiration is, let's say, loosely, so we do not try to mimic the exact behaviors of the ants, and also the robots look quite different, the robots that we are using than the ants. But we are fascinated by self-assemblages that occur in social insects like ants, and by the functions that they show, and want to bring them into robotics.
Can you tell us maybe why one would want a multiple robot system like this, as opposed to, say, because you just mentioned you can cross gaps, for example, why not just have a bigger robot? In what situations is it better to have multiple robots that can self-assemble instead of a big humanoid or something like that?
Well, typically, a robot with predefined characteristics is the best solution if you know exactly the application domain. Whereas when you don't know, for example, about the width of the gap, if you go on another planet, for example, you don't have humans that can, let's say, build bigger robots on demand. Then a system that can self-assemble can greatly help, because within a few seconds or minutes it can set up a robot that perfectly fits the task at hand.
Okay, what? Maybe tell us, now that we know why we would want to self-assemble, how do you self-assemble, and is it hard? Is it simply, I see another robot, I'm going to attach to him, or do you really have to have special tools or special algorithms to put robots together?
So there are, let's say, a range of connection techniques from the mechanical, electromechanical point of view. You can use, for example, mechanical hooks or pinhole mechanisms with the latches and magnetism you can exploit. From the software side, there are various approaches of bringing the robots together. One often used approach is that there is a single robot that seeds the entire process, and after that, other robots will join one by one the growing seed structure. So you can have several robots joining at the same time, but typically these are like independent processes, so every time the robots join individually. It's much more complex to have two large groups of connected robots and to let them assemble with each other, which would be possible and which would be interesting. However, at the moment, this is typically not the case what is done.
Okay, can you tell us maybe what are you working on right now? What are some of your latest results? How many robots can you attach together, or what kind of tasks do you do with assembled robots?
So during my PhD studies, I was working typically with mobile robots, let's say 1 to 16 robots, and I can let them form into a single structure. And for example, we have shown in computer simulations that the time to connect to the structure grows sublinearly with the size of the structure. So you have some properties like scalability. And we have also shown that these structures can be meaningful to cross a gap, to overcome a hill, or to transport a heavy object, for example. So you can transport an object that is too heavy to be transported by a single robot, and you can form a new robot, so the robots can themselves form a new robot that is large enough and powerful enough to transport a given object.
How about the practicality, maybe, of such a system? I understand you're in the research area, but have you seen multiple robots already somewhere commercially implemented that self-assemble, or that have a hard task, that come together? Is this anywhere near I guess, applicability, or are we still looking very far ahead to the future?
I'm afraid we are looking far ahead in the future. Currently, I'm not aware of any concrete application of these ideas. It's true that, for example, to self-assemble, it adds a lot of complexity into the system. It is also risky because you can. It's not for granted that it works out. And so, if you choose this strategy, you will only want the robots to do this if there is a lot of benefit. And so we have now a few rather toy problems that we are studying at the moment, and we hope that in the future there will be more, and that they will finally have their application in, for example, exploration tasks of unknown terrains.
Yeah, I get the feeling that this would be one of those things that would be nice if you'd send it to Mars, for example, because anywhere on Earth I can always imagine that, well, we could self-assemble some robots, but if it's, you know, right here in front of us, we can also make a bigger robot or something. But have you looked at any space applications, or has anyone approached you about space applications of such robots?
Well, I know that my supervisor, Marco Dorigo, was approached, I think, by NASA, because they were in general interested about the robots that were that we studied in the project that was called the SwarmBots project. I think they are interested in general on group transport and collective transport systems, to have flexible systems that can be adjusted to particular needs, because you have to consider that you want to minimize the weight that you carry up to the Mars, and therefore it is good to have a solution that can be adapted to particular needs afterwards and not already on Earth before sending it out.
Okay, maybe as another question. You've worked mostly with land-based robots. Do you see this being applicable at all to other types of robots, say robots in water or robots, flying robots, or is that just another dimension that is so much harder than land-based robots?
It is maybe more difficult. However, researchers around the globe are already looking into problems like self-assembling in three dimensions. So there is a group of Hodlibsen at Cornell University, for example, that investigates how modules that are floating passively in a tank of oil, for example, can assemble with each other. I think there's also work by, for example, Daniela Russ at MIT that looks for self-assembling systems underwater, so in the deep sea, for example. You could imagine also self-assembly scenarios in zero-gravity environments in the space, like satellite panels. So I think there is a lot of potential, of course, not always clear whether the algorithms that develop will always be applicable to all these situations. Sometimes they are specific to a particular problem domain.
So, Roderick has a final question. Tell us a little bit about your future work and the next project that you're working on right now.
So, at the moment, we are starting here at DPFL to extend the work on self-assembling systems towards the direction of artificial life. And actually, this builds on many different previous works of from various pieces of the literature. You can mention, for example, a work by Lionel and Roger Penrose in the 50s that looked at mechanical processes. So they constructed pieces out of water, and when they are shaked, they cannot just form organisms, they can also replicate these organisms. And there have been many more studies in this direction which show that self-assembling systems can be used to design replicating systems. And now one can easily imagine that one can add in such a system the functionality that when you can form organisms and you can replicate them, you could also add some mutation. You can let the organisms combine with each other. So you can have some type of evolutionary system. And, well, some of the ideas stem also from the seminal work of Carl Sims in the 90s that is trying to, using computer simulations, evolve not just the brain of an organism, but also the morphology. So what we are trying to do is to bring these different directions together and to have a system which is evolving in the physical world. So you would not have a human that is interfering with it, and you would not have a computer that is interfering with it. So you can imagine a population of, let's say, electromechanical units or simple robots that are, for example, floating on the surface of a liquid or in a three-dimensional environment, and they are recombining, etc., to form new organisms. They are organizing to some organisms they can replicate. And the one idea could be now to add some functionality to these organisms, so that they are not just information, they have some physical meaning. Mm-hmm. And, well, one way of adding functionality is to let them harvest energy in their environment. And you can say that those that are successful, that are harvesting energy, have the ability to reproduce because they have simply the time to do so. Whereas the others that are not successful, that run out of energy, will simply disband and they will break down. They cannot keep together. The organisms will die. So this leads to an evolutionary process, which in which the environment actually, and not a computer, is shaping the morphologies of the organisms. And I think this is a great dream of many scientists to come to this direction.
Okay, well, I wish you best of luck, and hopefully we'll see something interesting coming out of your lab soon.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to stop by the forum for discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Cooperate with robots. The podcast for news and views on robotics.